The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government. I'm joined by Kate Bonder. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Wadhwani AI Center, and a former advisor to the Ukrainian government, where she worked on defense reform and innovation during a period of rapid wartime adaptation.
So they created this unmanned system forces. They announced a recruitment of 160,000 drone operators. And when I listened to European NATO conversations around land conflict, tanks crossing the Baltic border, I'm like, guys, they will have 160,000 drone operators. Don't expect tanks to cross the border, especially in the beginning. Expect thousands of Shaheds crossing your airspace together with Gerberas and decoys and other systems which will distract and kill your air defenses.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 56, Drones and AI at War. A conversation with Kate Bonder. For decades, we talked about the future of war as something out on the horizon, years away, defined by emerging technologies and incremental change. Over the last 24 months, that future has arrived faster than expected. In Ukraine, we are seeing an inflection point. The shift is not just from one platform to another, but from individual systems to integrated networks. What we might call a drone ecosystem. These are data-driven architectures where AI is not just supporting operations, but increasingly shaping how the battle space is understood and contested. This is not simply about better hardware. It's about the speed of adaptation. The gap between a battlefield lesson and a deployed capability is now measured in weeks. Software updates can change outcomes in ways that used to require new equipment. As autonomy moves from the lab to the front line, it raises fundamental questions. When decision timelines compress, what remains under human control? Can decentralized innovation outpace centralized systems built for scale? And how do institutions adapt when the pace of change exceeds traditional processes? To help us think through this, I'm joined by Kate Bonder. She's a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a former advisor to the Ukrainian government, where she worked on defense reform and innovation during a period of rapid wartime adaptation. Kate Bonder, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi, it's so nice to be here. Thank you for inviting.
Oh, I'm the one who is benefited by listening to you repeatedly speak. In the last month, this is my sixth time sitting down. Well, first time sitting with you, sixth time listening to you. This morning you lectured to our class here at APCSS. Thank you for that.
It's such an honor, honestly.
we have an international, particularly Indo-Pacific-based student body, and I was listening to them talking about you in the breezeways, talking about the lecture, and it was how I felt when I listened to you in April when we were out there in the National Capital Region. You spoke to our class out there. You've been on three other podcasts in the last month. I mean, you're like a pro at this now.
Well, I'm still learning. I'm not a pro. I'm still learning.
I think it's almost fair to say that you're a leading voice in what we're going to talk about today, and so I am really grateful that you had time, that you could sit down and have this discussion today. The audience will appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, and I'm happy to talk about these topics because I think they're becoming more and more important right now, and people should understand what we're dealing with.
So with that then, I mean, let's start with the inflection point. What has changed, and what makes AI, in fact, a warfare operational tool right now? Why now?
Yeah, so, you know, during these 4 years of the war, AI really went through a transition from something unknown and something non-military because, you know, like In 2019, I got to the United States when I got a fellowship at Stanford. And at that time, I started exploration how AI can help Ukraine to fight, because we already had war, and how we can use AI in defense. And at that time, you know, in Silicon Valley and innovative community, they were like, oh no, we're not using AI in the military. It's like everyone was so afraid of this. So after the full-scale invasion, I think the state of affairs was more or less the same. But fast forward to this 4 years and where we're right now, AI has been has become a really commonized technology. So we're not, you know, we still haven't achieved full autonomy and full capacity and capability of AI, but it's being integrated in different applications at the edge for analytics, etc. So now it has become really an essential technology in the military and for defense. And no discussion is happening without AI being discussed and used for the military purposes. And I think it's a drastic change, not only how it's being used, but in the mindset that we have accepted the fact that it is a military technology and it's already being used and it will be used at broader scale. So there's a lot of open questions related to that. Happy to unpack.
You know, I think, I mean, I think you're right. I was not just in Ukraine, the Middle East. It's you hear about it in the news all the time. Recently read a book by Katrina Madsen, the Maven Smart System, yes. Right? Maven. And the type of thing you were speaking about, how people were hesitant to integrate it, particularly in combat operations. We got real war going on. We don't have time for this testing and stuff. And as I've listened to you, and we'll talk more about that, that has not been Russia's approach, where they've been standoffish because they're in combat operations, not to test a thing.
Russian approach and Ukrainian approach, there's like two big differences. And I would say that these two approaches actually reflect the attitude and approach to innovation and military use of AI in the West and in the East, if I may say so. And these are like completely different mindsets. And it's very interesting to see how this evolution happens and how they actually sometimes align, sometimes diverge, and find the differences, and actually to understand what our adversary is doing and what our response should be. So yeah, comparing Russian approach and Ukrainian approach would be really beneficial, I think, for our audience as well.
Well, do that. I mean, when you're talking about the centralized state-led system, the Russian system, mm-hmm. and this is in competition or juxtaposed to a distributed innovation base-driven approach that Ukraine has been doing. And these are two different practices. And so help us understand those and maybe even you know, the advantages or disadvantages of these.
Yeah, so let's start with Ukraine, because
okay.
We've seen the appearance of AI in the battlefield and in Ukrainian analytical systems a little bit earlier than in Russia. And as you mentioned, it's really decentralized system where we have a lot of players, we have a lot of startups, teams, innovative companies who are really good at basically weaponizing commercial technology. So, I mean, it sounds a little bit scary, but this is what really happens. Ukrainian teams take open source technology commercially available and customize it and tailor it for military use. So computer vision model, you know, it can be used for reading car license plates, right? But on the other hand, it can be trained for automatic target recognition. And this is where computer vision was really helpful for Ukrainians and for Ukrainian drone operators. But, and this decentralized system works really well because you can leverage a lot of talent pool, you can leverage a lot of teams and see what they offer, you know, what, and they offer different types of solutions, and the military has an opportunity to choose. But at the same time, you know, this competition, which exists in this so-called free market, let's call it a free market, doesn't allow teams to really invest into deep tech, into long R&D, into collecting really big data sets, into labeling them in a really high quality. Whereas Russia, on the contrary, is just the opposite. So they haven't started, straight away using what's available, and also they have limits and limits in access to technology because of sanctions, because of their own government. So Russians start, and they think as engineers. So they're like, okay, if we want to use AI, what's needed for AI? And the answer is always data, right? That's a foundation for any efficient AI. So Russians actually started with collecting big data sets, and it was made on a central level. So basically, the Minister of Defense made a decision that, okay, since now onwards, we're collecting all data feeds from our drone operators, and we're labeling and we're creating a huge data set. I'm not saying that Russians are not using this light versions of AI, like what can be also taken online and quickly trained to help recognize objects or to navigate. There's free open source solutions and software for drones, for example. But on a more strategic level, they have this approach where they build foundation first, so they collect this data. Now they on top of this data layer, now they're building software solutions which help to develop this situational awareness or creating common operating picture at scale. So it's not, random solutions from civilian engineers that has to penetrate into the military. It comes top down, and it's a huge project. And I think this aspect of Russian military innovation has been underestimated in the West because we still haven't seen a real product which we can give a name, like Maven Smart System, right? But I think in really near future, we will see the result of all these efforts because the foundation is not visible, right? It's only when you build a house, it becomes beautiful and people can take pictures. So Russians now approaching this stage where they can really start building their house. And that's where the biggest threat comes from.
You said several things I want to kind of pull on there just for a second. You spoke about this data set, which maybe had I not read the book that I just spoke about, it might have just gone past me. But then I recognized how actually difficult that is for accuracy, garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. And if the system can't recognize the data as it sees it because it's had too many anomalies, errors along the way, then it increasingly reduces. And so that end must be, labor intensive to have good data so it can really recognize and be efficient what it's trying to do. As you were talking about the Russian, what did you call it? The automated command and control system, ACCS, I think was the name you gave it when I read it in your paper.
It's a translation of their name, actually.
No, I'm sure it was. In fact, it's a good point is you're fluent in Russian, Ukrainian, and so you've been. What did I see? You number of Russian sources, 150 telegraph channels,
Telegram,
telegram channels that you were. Go ahead, say
Yeah,
them.
a little bit of
The
background,
sourcing, yeah.
resourcing and about me, how I conduct my research. So yes, as you mentioned, I'm Russian speaking, Ukrainian speaking. With Ukraine, it's a little bit easier because I was working with the Ministry of Defense and I have access, I have friends. It's not classified information that I'm using in my research, but I can conduct interviews and get information from people. But with Russia, it's much more difficult. So how I approach it, the Telegram is the messenger. It's like WhatsApp. It's a big deal in Russia. Now it's banned because probably Russian government felt that information is leaking from this source because they had, channels, they had groups of civilian engineers where they discuss, what the military needs, what they're working on, their problems with supply chain, and that helps us to understand the real dynamics in Russia-China relations because this is where everyone sources components, right? So I was reading those, conversations, trying to understand where the reality is, but I won't hide that I also used AI to analyze. Like, there's 150 Telegram channels. It's impossible to read them all and to, digest all that amount of information. So AI also helped me to, it's like my small OSINT or my small situational awareness system of what's going on inside Russian military innovation from civilian side. Of course, there's no access to their military conversations, but it's good enough to understand what they use, which models they use, where they take them from. Like, computer vision models, these are mostly YOLO. So it means that it's open source technology for autonomous navigation. They use Autopilot. This software has been used for drone racing and it's been adapted for military use. And a lot of such examples. Like, I was wondering where do they take this AI from? Because Russian LLM models, they're not sophisticated enough. They cannot even work with their own language and their own databases. So what I found out that they were using OpenWAVE models such as Mistral, such as Chinese like Qwen system, and also Llama, for example, surprisingly. So yeah, now Llama is not OpenWAVE. Luckily, that also cuts a lot of capability for Russians. But that just shows how, the militaries and countries limited in access to technology. And I think these are all other countries except the United States and China, basically, trying to figure it out and how openly available technology can be used for military and it's actually good. So I think that's also a new characteristic and trait of modern conflict, that it's not, only focused and narrowed down to military-industrial complex and what it can produce and deliver to the military. Like, it's a closed, silent world of classified technology, information, and everything. It's just, merges with commercially available technology, and basically anything can be weaponized. Drones, software, and 3D printing. There's a lot of examples that, the things that we use in our everyday life now work for the battlefield.
Not only can be, but I guess are being weaponized. It's some of that is perhaps because of the necessity of that people find themselves in, that we resort to certain things. Your writing of this made me, it was about 25 years ago, I was researching for my second book on the North Korean People's Army, Origins and Current Tactics, How They Fight. And I was relying on, of course, there was no AI or internet, but I was relying on the sources, which are extremely important. The original sources, when you're doing something like that, and having access and being able to read that is critical for those who can't and then need to understand. And we definitely there's so much we need to learn from what's going on. You're thinking.
No, I'm just thinking, your example with North Korea, it's very interesting because, we're always trying to find tools and measures how we can limit our adversaries to in access to resources, right? And technology and hardware, compute, this is also crucial resource right now. And I'm just thinking, how sanctions really work. And it makes me think about other questions, like if we cannot effectively limit the access of our adversaries to technology, because we cannot, it's a fact. I can prove it a little bit later. Like, what should we do? How should we respond to their adaptation, to their progress, to their advancement in use of AI? Because, okay, Russians actually deployed fully autonomous weapon system, right? Something that we might also have, but we're so concerned about ethical principles, about international law, about really important things. But they are important until we get to the war, right? Or we face an adversary who has this capability. And then we're going to ask ourselves, okay, so what do we have? Do we have this capability? Do we know how to use it? Do we have trained people? Do we have adapted doctrine? Do we have logistics and et cetera, et cetera? So basically, you know, not being able to effectively control the technological development, I think we need to think about our response in this situation.
Let's tease out a lot of what you just brought up. So let's take training to begin with first. And we often, you know, focus on the platforms. Do I have these number of things? But I mean, you've highlighted that training is a key channel for AI integration. If you don't know how to do the thing, you use the thing. And so how is Russia using its training pipelines then to accelerate the adoption of AI-enabled tactics at scale?
Yeah, so Russia also went through and still going through this, you know, changing of mindset, adaptation cycle that I would say, because in training as well as in technology, they were relying on usual formal military training and education, starting with infantrymen and finishing with officers and generals and commanders. So it was also very military industry, right? And nobody was allowed to interfere there. But drones happen to be something new that the old training system wasn't, you know, ready for, and they didn't have answers what to do with that. And that's where we saw the emergence of private drone schools, also established by volunteers, and basically they deliver the same product. I mean, it's service, it's not the tangible actual product, or it's not software, but it has the same importance and is the same crucial. So what is interesting about these private drone schools? First of all, they are capable of adapting really fast. As any startup, they're smaller, they're more agile, they're not so regulated, they don't have layers of bureaucracy, etc. Usually in those schools, they employ either former or current drone operators who have real battlefield experience, who know what they do, and who can actually share this experience, not the, no offense, but, you know, instructors in formal military education and training, but people with real battlefield experience. And for those schools, it's pretty easy to employ them, especially if they're not active duty, and many of them are not. So these people know what they do. They learn how to train. Then the military realized the value of this approach, and they started sending their operators for reskilling, upskilling, and also training to these schools rather than to their, you know, training centers. So basically, they established, you know, this knowledge supply from the battlefield to drone schools, who can get firsthand feedback, experience, like, you know, information from the actual battlefield, and they started accumulating this information, this knowledge, and converting it into fast update of their curriculum. So it's like iteration on technology, but it's iteration on curriculum. And these drone schools provide the most relevant, I would say, actual knowledge and tactical implement usage of drones. And like, this is something that, you know, formal bureaucratic system cannot keep up with. And one more important aspect is that these schools have actually become an innovation hubs, because for them as private entities, it's so much easier to work with startups, with any companies. You know, they're not limited with what's allowed for the military to buy. You know, they don't have blue UAS list or anything like this. They can buy any system, they can work with any manufacturer, and those manufacturers and startups, they bring their technology to drone schools, and they give them into hands of these drone operators who come from the battlefield. And this is where this communication happens, and, you know, testing and training together. So end users and future end users can actually provide feedback real time to manufacturers. And that increases this feedback loop and accelerates it so fast that manufacturers can iterate on their systems much faster than, you know, having this communication through official channels or even like with end users on the battlefield. So they have become a really important piece of this innovation ecosystem, especially in drone warfare, electronic warfare, software around drones, that I would say this is also something new, like a new phenomena for the military, is to consider how to integrate the schools and private training providers into broader, you know, training pipeline for the military?
I'm not unfamiliar with training in combat, but 4.5 decades ago, when I first started out in the military, I was a little bit taken back. Hadn't considered that that would be something you would need to do, is train while you're in combat. Of course, I've come to realize, and I had responsibilities in Afghanistan with providing trainers and different things, and all that entailed. But even listening to your description, seems to be the rapidity and the feedback and the iteration of it all seems to be really at a quick clip, really perhaps different than even than what I had considered.
Yeah, I think, technology development accelerates, and again, AI is a factor to that because now AI helps to even design systems, improve systems, helps to analyze feedback faster because it comes from different sources and different forms. Previously, you had to read reports and you had to think them through, and then you had to extract, what you have to do. Now it's done in minutes or even seconds. Right, so just the innovation development cycle accelerates, and together with this, all aspects of integration have also to decrease to increase accelerate. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I want to tease out something else you spoke about. You spoke about this human dimension, and with the rapidity of this autonomous warfare and how the challenge perhaps becomes actually being able to keep up with it, to process it all as it's coming in. And so at what point does human oversight become a constraint rather than a safeguard, and are we approaching that threshold?
That's a question that I don't have an exact answer to. I think we should we just see how kill chain is being more and more automated, more and more autonomous. Human might be left less and less space, where people can actually interfere into this kill chain. And yes, speed is an advantage on the battlefield. Everyone knows it. But currently, human judgment and human decision is kind of a safeguard, right? A guardrail, how not to allow an error to be committed by AI, for example, or by technology. But we had this interesting discussion today during the lecture and the seminar. Is human judgment really a safeguard? Because people are prone to emotions, people are prone to stress. And I've seen this, how this works, because when a commander sees 70 targets on the small screen, not even small screen, okay, let it be a big screen, but it's 70 targets, and you have what, 2, 3 minutes to make a decision? Like, can we really rely on this decision? Can we really, I wouldn't say trust, but it's just, human brain is not capable of processing this amount of information in this amount of time. So basically what AI offers is, data fusion from all sensors, from all data sources, and here's your output. And yes, human is in the loop. Human is making a decision, but who can guarantee that it's the right decision? Whereas maybe a machine could make a more informed and so-called right decision because it can weigh so many more factors, so much more information when making a decision on selecting a target and selecting assets to use to destroy this target, et cetera, et cetera. So, when I look at this technological development and I compare it with human process, human-led process, sometimes I question myself, is human process, human-led decision really better than a machine-led decision? And there is a point of view when people are and engineers are saying that probably we can program machines, including AI, in such a way that they are motivated or obligated to avoid collateral damage. When people have an emotion of hate to your enemy, can do this intentively with an intention to kill more people and to cause more collateral damage or civilian casualties that also exists in a war, right? Maybe it's not very common to talk about it, but it is true. It's present, it's there. So maybe technology can help us limit human factor in the bad sense in this.
My mind is racing with thoughts as you're speaking. I came in the Army a few years after Vietnam, and we spoke a lot about My Lai massacre, which was exactly as you're speaking here, which was humans who were extremely emotionally upset about their own people who had been killed, and then they took it out in a village. My mind raced over to one of my colleagues, Lucas Filler, just wrote the closing chapter in my latest book, Responsibility in the Machine Age of Warfare, which is this thing you're getting after. You use the term human in the loop, and it is, you know, as if though the human is looking, considering, and then letting it pass through. And you've also, I'm sure, heard the term human on the loop, which is then, you know, looking for something bad along the way, but pretty much it's going. And then I thought, is it the luxury of winning that allows you to be more discreet? And if you are losing or not doing so well, then suddenly letting it go by because you're trying to catch up, as it were. These are tough questions, aren't they? I think we're still trying to grapple with them. I have no doubt that Russians and Ukrainians are grappling with those as well right now.
100%, yes. And this is already happening. And, you know, situation differs case by case, mission by mission. What I can say is that we already have a technology which can keep human on the loop. We can remove human from the loop. So, you know, basically, yes, a human can intervene and stop the system, change the mission, whatever, right? But if we want to, probably we can already have fully autonomous, you know, kill chain from detection to destruction. It depends how much we trust it, how much we want, how much we accept the error, and how much we accept you know, that something might go wrong. And the thing is that, you know, our adversaries like Russia has much more freedom to experiment with this because they don't care that much about regulation, about international law. Obviously, when even starting this war, they already broke all the rules and broke the international system, right? And same applies to autonomous weapon systems, same applies to autonomous kill chain. If this gives them an advantage, they would definitely employ it. Like, there's no hesitation or consideration. We are in the West are more constrained because we have a luxury of living in peace and choosing, like, what risk can we take? To which extent we're ready to accept this risk, right? We still have time to experiment with the systems, and that's what I'm encouraging the militaries in the West to do. Start experimenting, start training, start really understanding how systems perform, how software works, where are the real risks, where we can remove human from the loop, where we can keep human on the loop, and where we only can keep human in the loop. So no decision is made without a human, right? I think that depends on, again, case by case, you know, where the stakes are high, such as nukes, for example. Right. Definitely human has to be in the loop, right? But, you know, there are different approaches to this problem. But, like, my message is that it's already happening there. I think we should also start experimenting and testing and sensing and feeling how this works in practice a little bit more, just in case if we need to deploy autonomy and fully autonomous systems and trust AI, we know what to expect.
So let me pull you on this one. Is there a winning model? We've kind of talked about this now around it, and I mean, you talked about the effectiveness of making decisions under pressure, and the scale-driven centralized system or the adaptive network one. You laid these two out, and so is there a winning model here? What would you?
If someone knew the winning model or the winning formula, I think they would already use it, right?
Pressing into it.
But I think every country, every military should really analyze lessons learned, analyze every conflict emerging in the world, and see what's applicable to their military, their theaters, their environment where they live, geopolitical situation, geography, et cetera, et cetera. Speaking of the model, and very often this question is asked, like, should we choose a decentralized model or a centralized model? That might be a blend, that might be a combination, because even Russia is not a fully centralized model. Like, everyone ex perceives Russia as a dictatorship, authoritarian regime, which is true, but it doesn't apply to their military that much nowadays. Because just today I had a 4-hour call from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Ouch.
on Honolulu time with Europe, and it was NATO related, and we were discussing Russian threat. You know what surprised me is that the perception, even in Europe, in European militaries, is very often, of Russian military, is that they will fight with Red Army, but it's not Red Army anymore. I mean, Russia of 2026 is so far from Russia of 2022, and they are adapting, and part of their adaptation is moving from this hardly, rigid and centralized military. Because, like, I'll give you an example. So they have this experimental best elite unit, drone unit called Rubicon. Everyone knows about Rubicon because it's the most successful. They have cool marketing, cool videos. That's what militaries do nowadays as well. So it's a unit which actually consists of civilians, but these are just best operators, united under one roof. And what Russians have done, they experimented based on this unit with everything. What types of systems and drones they use, how they use them, how they establish repair, maintenance, supply, adjustment of their systems, who they recruit, how they train these people, how they establish logistics, et cetera, et cetera. So now they have this best practices, and what Russians, again, coming back to the question, like, they build a foundation, so they figure it out, and now they will scale it. And now they created a separate service, separate branch in their military. It's like, Air Force, Navy, and now it's Unmanned Systems Forces. Ukrainians did it quite a long time ago, but it was, chaos, and it was ad hoc, and it was like, not very structured. But Russians, they're like, okay, now we understand how this must work. These are the best practices. Now we're just going to scale them. So they created this Unmanned System Forces. They announced a recruitment of 160,000 drone operators. And when I listen to European NATO conversations around land conflict, tanks crossing the Baltic border, I'm like, guys, they will have 160,000 drone operators. Don't expect tanks to cross the border, especially in the beginning. Expect thousands of Shaheds crossing your airspace, together with Gerberas and decoys and other systems, which will distract and kill your air defenses. And then probably you will see tanks when all the job is done on, destruction of air defenses, destroying of energy, fuel supply, logistics, everything that is in small little Baltic countries. So I cannot guarantee, but that might be a scenario. So Russians are not thinking as a Red Army anymore. Their adaptation is a combination of centralized and decentralized system. And I think they really figured it out how to use this effectively. You know, the rigid hierarchical military order together with leveraging civilian, you know, talent pool and basically building something new inside their conventional military system. They have this, you know, resistance inside, like old school generals who know how to do stuff the old way, and they resist this innovation. Yes, it's also present. But, you know, in parallel with that, they're building a completely new army, unmanned army, with lots of operators. They know how to train them. They have already scaled production of Shahed drones. They localized the components, almost everything except electronics. And here we come back to sanctions problem, because over 50% of electronics in Russian systems come from companies headquartered in the United States. Japan and Switzerland follow. So they're really good at adaptation, and they leverage everything, you know, civilian talent, commercial technology, commercial components, and of course, institutional adaptation, which is super hard for such a huge military and bureaucratic system.
And they've got North Korean workers in their plants that working with them alongside. So that helps when your manpower is all out in the field and North Koreans are in there doing that, and they're working on they call them Grons. Is that what they call the Shaheds? And of course, that technology is proliferating there as well. I was thinking when you're talking about these, you know, what's coming across first is all these drones.
Mm-hmm.
Treating, I guess it was Hedgehog 2025. So a NATO exercise.
Yeah, the New York Times article.
You read about that one, right?
Yeah.
So I'll say a little bit and you can say more on it. So a little over a year ago, NATO exercise where they were NATO force fighting an op four, which was Ukrainian, and they found that quickly they were ill adapted. To be able to fight a modern fight,
mm-hmm.
And realize that they have to make these changes quickly. Your point was, if you're expecting to fight a certain way, you probably ought to be thinking about fighting another way. And that exercise I was reading about that you just mentioned was in the New York Times, seemed to be a bit of a reason for pause for a moment, that maybe are we taking the right lessons? Are we not being dismissive, overly dismissive of, you know, that maybe that's the way they're fighting because they got no other choice, but in fact the character of war may be changing as well?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. You know, I think we're here in the West, we're learning the right lessons. I mean, you know, changes that are happening right now in the Department of War, like change in acquisition system, launching these new programs, drone dominance, and the Army has actually launched a jailbreak, I think, Operation Jailbreak, when they want to recreate something like Delta system in Ukraine. So they're fusing different data sources, they're building a platform where everything is integrated and it can be used for situational awareness, common operating pictures, etc. Because JADC2 been sitting there for years and we haven't seen
Joint All Domain Command and Control System. This is the US's system, which is top down, I guess.
It's everything. I've seen so many definitions of it. It's a platform, it's a system, it's an approach, it's a concept. And I'm like, what is it? Like, where is it? Like, can we touch it? And nobody has an answer to that.
Right.
So when something is very abstract and too big, it's really hard to implement it. But now that the Army has seen the value of this software and, you know, it's an essential part from modern warfare, they're like, okay, now we have a goal and now we know what to do. And now we know the most important part, we know what we want to achieve. And they want to achieve this system which would integrate everything and help them manage this unmanned system, including unmanned systems. So I'm just trying to say that the emphasis has always been on technology, because there is a perception that, oh, if we have a silver bullet, then we're just going to win,
yeah,
or enemies won't even attack us. It's like main deterrence factor, right? But it's not only about technology. With drones, now we have a problem of integration. And while I'm trying to focus and, emphasize integration all the time, is because I met with US units who actually got drones and the problem with procurement and acquisition kind of solved. But then they're like, we don't know what to do with them. And they're lying in boxes somewhere. And that's it. And they're like, you know what? Nobody taught us how to fight with drones. We know our stuff. We know we have our tactics. If we have a task of cleaning that room, we're just going to go blow everything up as we usually do. And why do we need this hustle with drones? It's just an additional headache, which I get. I mean, if you're not trained, like, why would you start experimenting and inventing something when you don't see any value in this, right? So,
The North Koreans thought that too when they first got on the battlefield, and then they were killed in the thousands and realized they had to change their approach if they were going to survive.
it's a good motivation, right?
That was a good movie.
Yeah, so the integration part is same important as technology
Yeah.
itself.
So as we think about this integration and this speed versus a coordination, and you talked about JADC2. And what makes JADC2 even more complicated is when you add the C in front of it, combined, joint all domain command and control. And so can alliances move fast enough to compensate with these more centralized state-driven systems?
Of course they can. I mean, we people build these systems, and it depends on us how we build them, how many layers of bureaucracy we create, and we can also remove these layers of bureaucracy. And Russia and Ukraine are perfect examples for this because both countries inherited Soviet system, which was very bureaucratic, and both countries, in different ways, removed unnecessary milestones, approvals, all these steps on the way to actual capability and integrating it. So I think on international level, with our allies, we can achieve the same. Yes, it's 10x harder because you need to fight many bureaucracies, but to achieve combined command and control, joint all domain command and control. Yeah, we just need, and I'm not a big fan of standards, but still we need to at least find common approaches to technology development, software development, make things easily integratable and interoperable between each other. For different types of things, there are different approaches. For software, it's one approach, for hardware, another. But it's like with plugs and cables for phones, right? We finally came to one single format or like a standard
And I plug in anything.
across the world. So it should be the same approach. I know in the military it's much harder, but it's doable.
Well, I would think that the absence of standards is what makes CJADC2 so hard, is if every defense company with their proprietary information develops a thing and they don't communicate with each other, you can't create that kill chain you're expecting, because you can't get, and then when you add the internationals, it's even more complicated. And if you say everybody needs to do this thing here, then they would work to that, perhaps.
I do agree with you, James. If you talk to companies, they won't
They won't.
because
That's right, because there's no incentive to.
no incentive. They hate standards.
Yeah.
They say that it's limiting their innovation, which is maybe partially true, but there has to be approaches, like open interfaces, publishing of the documentation, so everyone can actually make things work and, talk to each other. So these small little changes, at the, I don't know, edge of your system, not changing what's inside, but just, creating this plugins, that would probably help to change the situation. But again, this abbreviation is pretty big. Combined, joined, all domain, command and control. I think we should move backwards. So first we should establish and digitalize command and control, then add all domain, cross domain collaboration, because now there's a problem of communication even between services, right? They don't want to buy the same stuff. Like Air Force doesn't want to buy what Navy is buying if it's the same title. I heard cases when companies had to rename stuff just
Right.
for it to look different, so different services can buy. And these are like extreme ridiculous cases, but this is something which really exists. And I'm still wondering, like in the United States, every service develops their own command and control system. Why? When it has to be joined, right? So when we close this gap, we can move to join, to combined.
Let me pull you on a couple more things. We're running short on time. So when this goes well, I imagine it goes very well. And when it doesn't go well, then it starts to fail. And so, what is when we think about these risks, what are most likely the failure points that that will cause this not to work? What we're talking about.
Do you mean command and control or like technology in
The
more
broader we've been speaking
broader?
about, the drone and AI here and.
Trust me, there are so many things that can go wrong, especially.
But even though they've been going wrong, they've been still applying them in combat in Ukraine.
Hey, when something goes wrong, you learn your lesson. Maybe sometimes the hard way and the stakes are too high and the price is too high, but you still learn and then you improve the system or technology or approach or training or where you identify this gap, and it helps you to get closer to perfection, if I may say so. But nothing is actually completed or finished or perfect anyways, right? But I think to minimize this risk of that something might go wrong, we should test more, experiment more. We should move from PowerPoint presentations and labs to operational environment. I think the militaries should look into Russian and Ukrainian lessons in terms of when is actually that point of time where they're ready to work with technology. To take it from, engineers and to start testing with it. Because now what is happening in the West, like the Department of Defense comes with money and says, develop us this capability. Here is the funds. And you have, well, now it's changing, but previously it's like you have time and money, so start working on R&D concept and all that kind of stuff. And you never know if it's going to be delivered or not. Whereas in Ukraine and Russia, the militaries are saying, we need this solution and please bring it in a working condition. So, like TRL 6-7, better 9, okay, 6-7. So, basically, you get a working product. You don't get a promise in a contract or a PowerPoint presentation. You get already working product. So, and that product you can take and test and evaluate and train with it. While you're training, you're working with it longer time in different situations and different scenarios. So you get more feedback, which you can provide for the manufacturer so they can improve the system. So I think that's the part that here in the West we're still missing, because we have to be, tougher on innovators, and we have to accept prototypes on higher TRLs just to minimize this risk and time of wasting time on believing in, and expecting the capability. And when we experiment, when we train, this is where we see all the failures, what's not working. Just to give you a couple of examples, in Russia and Ukraine, Western companies, okay, in Ukraine, Western companies come with super cool drone, expensive, beautiful, looks cool, costs a lot of money, huge company with venture capital and Department of War backing, and like everything looks just so shiny and nice. Ukrainians take this drone to the battlefield and it doesn't even start. Why? And it's also autonomous, of course, as everything else. Why? Because when GPS is jammed, system just doesn't start, it doesn't even fly because it doesn't have any orientation. A more simple example, it starts, it flies, and out of the sudden it's getting lost and it falls. Why? Because there was a condensation. It was in November or December. It's pretty cold in Ukraine. And there was a condensation between two glasses, the glass of the camera and glass which protects this camera glass. And it got frozen. And the super cool drone just went blind. And it couldn't orientate. It couldn't perceive the environment. And all this AI and everything failed just because of this small little thing. Another example is when, you know, the drone was delivered to the front line. They open it, and then they see that the cables were eaten by mice. So these are the things that you cannot recreate in the lab. You cannot predict. And that's why I'm always motivating companies to test and test and test their stuff in close to operational environment or in operational environment. All these systems that were frozen or, you know, in Ukraine come from Arizona testing ranges where they never see, you know, frost, where they never face below zero, you know, flight conditions. Now they test them in Alaska. But previously, companies are like, yeah, but it was developed according to Department of War requirements. And, you know, we were testing it multiple times, like where? In Arizona. That's your answer. So the answer, how to reduce failure, is to just throw it in reality, and the reality will show if it's working or not.
Fascinating. I think I'm gonna move us to audience questions, and I might even take us a little long. You've only been up since 2 a.m., so what's a few more minutes?
Sure.
So this first one's asking about the small state adaptation. So how can smaller militaries use drones and AI to create meaningful operational advantage at a relatively low cost?
So yeah, the answer is commercial technology. It's accessible, it's relatively low cost because, you know, when you scale production of anything, including software, it becomes cheaper. So rather than developing and recreating actually the same functionality, but in classified, super secret way, sometimes it's just easier to adapt commercial technology and use it. Russians were using Telegram, Russians were using Discord, the system for engineers, almost everywhere across the battlefield until their own government banned it as a very evil Western technology, I mean, Discord. So yeah, that's how commercial tech, yes, it of course creates risks and some vulnerabilities. But in general, for smaller countries which don't have huge military budgets, which don't have time to develop, you know, go through all R&D processes, it's easier to take something that already exists and just customize, adapt, tailor it to your needs and to your theater and environment.
I saw your slides where you had a basic drone and all the adaptations that put this on there, made a bomber on it, put this, made a kamikaze on it, put this, made a ISR, put this on it, made a relay, etc. And it was just a plug and play, as it were, to create a capability from a standard baseline.
Right. The only non-military stuff, the only military stuff there was this explosive device like a grenade or basically explosive, which is not very commercial thing. But all the rest, you want to create an ISR capability, you buy GoPro, you attach it to a drone, and here you go. Or you buy an antenna, that's your relaying system. Or you can 3D print anything else. Like now they're printing cases for explosives. Now they're printing bomb release devices. A lot of additional parts, which turn a drone to a completely different capability.
This next question is asking about maritime conflict. And so what developments in AI-enabled drones could most change the character of maritime conflict in the years ahead, as you think?
You know, that's also a very good question. And I think for maritime, especially like in the Pacific theater, where distances are so big that no fiber optic cable, no radio connection is actually useful. So what is left is satellite connection and software. Satellite connection is also a little bit challenging because you need, well, Now it's only Starlink, basically.
That's right.
And you, when you're limited to only one vendor, it always creates a risk. You know, Elon Musk's mood changes and he.
Turns it on, turns it off.
Right. So I think we should learn that lesson as well. Whereas software can be developed by multiple vendors, you can customize it, adjust it to whatever need you have. And yes, it can solve the problem of unmanned systems for sea domain. And basically, with underwater, it's a little bit more difficult, but still, autonomy, AI-enabled autonomy is a good solution. With underwater, it's even harder because no satellite connection, fiber optic, or radio. So I would say it's only AI-enabled autonomy. And, you know, people were trying to create unmanned sea systems from 16th century, and only with solving this connectivity issue, they succeeded basically installing Starlink and enabling this connectivity to the operator. Imagine if we remove operator from the picture, right? And if we get fully autonomous system, then it's not limited to anything, basically only, I don't know, fuel tank probably. But all the rest, it solves a lot of problems for maritime domain.
Yeah. This next question is asking about counter swarm defense. I'll ask the question, but I've listened to you talk about swarming, and maybe you might even explain that a bit. But the question is, what approaches look most promising for defending against large-scale drone and swarm attacks? So now maybe talk about the swarm and the counter swarm.
Yeah, so we should distinguish between real swarming and just a group of drone, because real swarming is when drones can distribute tasks in this group, and it doesn't matter how many of them there are. A group of drones can also fly with the pre-programmed routes, paths, in a pre-programmed formation, but this is what generally, you know, distinguishes and differs real autonomy versus algorithmic autonomy. So in a swarm, there are different types of swarm. There is like one node which controls others. There is distributed network. Doesn't really matter, but the principle is the same, that drones get a task, a goal from a human, and then they figure it out by themselves how to achieve this goal. It's comparable to what people are doing, right? Nobody tells you, well, shouldn't tell you, like, if you want to go from A to B, you have to move your one leg, another leg, right? So you're figuring it out by yourself. That's what drones do in a swarm. And that's what makes them dangerous, because you never know how they solve the problem of achieving the goal, how they actually try to achieve this goal. And in most of the cases, they are fully autonomous. They have to be fully autonomous. It's, again, it's not a solved problem yet and not fully deployed yet, but the goal of having a swarm is to make them fully autonomous. So they also don't rely on this connection to the operator. So,
And Russia is well advanced in trying to figure this out.
yes, Russia, I wouldn't say they have super advanced technology, but they're advanced in
I guess I didn't necessarily mean the technology, but in the process of thinking this through, they've been pro.
process of deploying and experimenting in real battlefield. So, and the question of how to counter this threat is one of the most actual and open questions, because a swarm can consist of five drones, that what Russians are doing, 5 to 10, but this can be 1,000, and it doesn't really matter because the principle is the same. So if there is 1,000 drones, then there is a question what countermeasures you have.
Electronic warfare, maybe. But I guess maybe if it's not receiving a signal, it's not
Yes,
going
it's
to
not
affect it
working.
either.
It's not working.
Yeah.
What you can jam, and again, it depends how drones communicate inside a swarm, because what Russians are doing, they are placing Wi-Fi, like short range Wi-Fi routers. So basically, they can talk to systems which are close by. But there's also a different approach when they use visual navigation. So they just see, like birds in a flock, there are thousands of them, and they just see the close by birds, and they adjust their movements and their flight accordingly to the swarm. And there's nothing to jam there. So electronic warfare doesn't work. Kinetic countermeasures, depending on the price. If it's a swarm of small group one FPV drones and you have Patriots, doesn't make sense, right? Even if these are Shaheds and you have Patriots, doesn't make sense. So probably these are like also swarms of interceptor drones. All things related to lasers. I see a potential for lasers in future, but maybe, because a laser itself is cool, but you need a huge, power supply and a generator for that. So to deploy that system on the battlefield, you will become with that laser the first biggest target. Same with all this microwave grilling, and it might look cool in demo, but deploying that huge thing on the battlefield, again, you will be the first and the biggest target because you emit a lot of signal, and the swarm just gonna attack and basically destroy you. So there is again no silver bullet for this, and I think approach that Ukrainians naturally and organically have developed right now, which is called layered defense, is the best answer to this because it's a combination of different technologies, kinetic, electronic warfare, interceptors, starting with small interceptor drones to missiles to fighter jets to helicopters, and they all work together. And only in such a company, something is being shot down by lasers as well. So it's only a combination and layers of air defenses, probably, which can solve this problem.
Next question is asking about human capability. So, what new skills and training will future military forces need the most in an era of AI-enabled warfare?
That's when students or students at school ask me like, what skills we need for the future in AI future? Like, I don't know what skills will save me tomorrow, and you're
Right.
asking me about the future. It's the same thing here because I think it's not like separate skills that we can develop right now in our war fighters. It's how we create institutional agility and adaptability. That what can define and help us to react fast to this technological development. So I would say that speed of institutional adaptation, this is what will really matter, because if we can adapt fast as a military, with all procedures, regulations and everything, we have the business processes that we have inside, we will be able to retrain people faster. We will be able to adjust their skills faster accordingly to what is needed at a particular point of time. And I would say that it's more important rather than trying to build, a skill set right now and thinking that it's going to be good to go for the next 10 years. I don't think we have that luxury anymore.
I'm going to ask one more question. We had hundreds of people sign up and ask questions in this live showing, and so we're never going to ask all of them, but one more. Governance and rules. Where do you see the greatest need and limitations for international rules governing military AI and autonomy?
Well, the greatest limit right now is absence of common approach and agreed approach among at least, allies, because I don't believe that we will find common language around this with our adversaries. It would be great, but other regimes just proved that you can sign an agreement, you can sign arms control regime, but what if an administration comes in any country and decides to quit or just does whatever they want? Like, I don't think that would be a solution. If we agree, at least among allies, on our approach to how to identify things, because now I see so many definitions of autonomy, and when we talk about autonomy, everyone understands different things. So we should find like common definition here, and then we should just develop approach how we address these issues. As I said, and as I mentioned, we should allow more experimentation in controlled environment. We should really analyze better the risks of technology. We should probably develop some levels of risk acceptance, etc. So the general message is that we should start working with this, not being afraid, not trying to establish control, restrict innovation, because it won't bring us everywhere. It just will increase the gap between us and adversaries, rather than trying to understand technology. And probably when we see something, when we identify a risk, we codify it in some sort of regulation. And that regulation can be then translated into technology, how it performs. Going back to our conversation, how technology can reduce human factor and risks related to human behavior. So probably the answer would be start working on this, seeing, and then, following how technology develops rather than developing hypothesis and trying to limit everything, whereas maybe it's not needed.
Before I let you go, I'd like to ask for book recommendations. Maybe you might share one with us.
The book recommendation relevant to this conversation, because I would like to, follow this conversation, would be the book called Breakneck.
Oh, I've read it by Dan Wong.
Yes.
Very good book.
Yes. So you read it and probably you understand better.
The know-how is what matters.
Know-how what matters, and how Chinese and Russians are thinking, and how our systems differ, right, in the West and in the East. I'm not saying that it's a competition between lawyers and engineers, but to some extent it is. It is. And I think this book just lays a foundation for and gives some food for thought, like what would be the better model, like how we can blend probably these two approaches, because every extreme is bad. Yeah. And somewhere in the middle, or to the left or to the right from this middle, would be an optimal model for us and for our advantage in future. So yeah, I would recommend to read that book to better understand on a broader scale how things work and how mindsets are working in different parts of the world.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you for spending this hour with us, for being here in the studio. It has been my pleasure to have this conversation, so thank you.
Likewise, it was a pleasure to have this conversation and being here.
Yeah. As we conclude today's dialogue, this conversation reminds us that the defining shift in modern conflict is not just technological. It is the speed at which systems learn, adapt, and act. AI and autonomy are not future capabilities. They are shaping outcomes now. The advantage will not go to those who simply possess advanced systems, but to those who can integrate them, scale them, and evolve them faster than their competitors. For policymakers and practitioners, the challenge is clear. Adapt institutions, decision-making, and partnerships to a pace of change that no longer allows for delay. These conversations shape security. On behalf of all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining us for this important dialogue. Many thanks to Kate Bonder for her insights. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha hoi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.